Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story It's Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yes, indeed. This week is episode number 91. Exciting. And we're going to talk about a book called Ashes to Ashes by Emma Lathen. L-A-T-H-E-N. This is an author I had never heard of.
Unfortunately, I feel, it's an author way too many people have forgotten. And these are mysteries. They used to be really popular. I remember my parents would always bring home the new Emma Lathen, but now have sadly fallen into, well, I can't say ignominy. That implies they're not very good. But people have forgotten them because they're not really being republished. Libraries, you know, are kind of clearing off the shelves and getting rid of them, so you have to grab them from secondhand stores. But they really took, I think, a unique approach. And I say they because Emma Lathen was two American businesswomen. And this wasn't known until really recently, actually. Everybody knew Emma Lathen as a person, but there weren't ever any interviews or things like that that I know of. But it was an economist, Mary Jane Latsis, and an economic analyst, Martha Hennessert. So the fact that these are heavily based around Wall Street and economics and business is not a surprise. But what is a surprise maybe when you hear that is that they're very readable, very understandable. And their main detective, well, their only detective really, who's a Wall Street banker, is, I just love John Putnam Thatcher.
yeah, that's his name. So it's called a John Putnam Thatcher mystery. And apparently all the books by Emma Lathen are these, or, you know, John Putnam Thatcher mysteries. So he's a Wall Street financial guy. And the very first paragraph in the book, you know, it starts out, you know, Wall Street is the largest and most efficient market in the world has ever known. And then after that, you're like, well, what did that have to do with anything, you know? but it's interesting that both of these authors are economists. That makes sense, you know. And you know, the reason that John Putnam Thatcher is involved with the mystery at all does have to do with the fact that he's a financial guy. So it's not that finance has nothing to do with this book, but it really isn't about Wall Street in any way.
No, he's the senior vice president of Sloan Guaranteed Trust, which is established in all these books as one of these huge banks that has its fingers in financial pies all over the world. So he gets called into all kinds of different situations as he is needed to look at different businesses or whatever financing or different departments that need to be reorganized. And that takes him to all over the world. But also it takes the reader into all these different businesses. And so from this one, which I picked because it had to do with a Catholic school being closed and being replaced by a huge apartment building.
Yeah, and, but before you go on, are a lot of these books, is there a Catholic connection in most of them or just this one?
No, this is the only one. And actually I have some that I actually like better, but I was really interested in how well they portrayed the Catholic mindset in this and some of the struggles that the Catholic communities have gone through. And what was always interesting to me is I would be fascinated not only by the mystery where there'd always be a murder, and his curiosity was always his besetting sin. So he'd always get interested enough to kind of show up at all these extra things in each mystery. That's how he usually gets involved. And so the different mysteries will do things like look at the Olympics. Like there's one set at Lake Placid when it was there. There's one set in a chocolate factory, which is supposed to be like Hershey's chocolate. There's one set at a car place, like, you know, which would be like Ford or something. And I never thought about how much you were learning about how these industries themselves worked until I was rereading this one for this podcast going, Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. I recognize that now that I'm Catholic. I recognize this now that I'm Catholic. And I thought, wow, they were able to get into that. They understood all these little elements so well that they must have really represented all that other stuff really well, too.
Hmm. Well, that's great. As I was poking through these books, there's about 20 of them. The highest rated one appears to be one called When in Greece. 1969. This book was written in 1971. But When in Greece was a finalist for the Edgar Award. Just wanted to throw that out there. So I'm going to look for that one because I did enjoy this book.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Yeah, it did have like an Agatha Christie feel to me, especially, you know, at the end at the reveal and the explanation, you know, that felt very Agatha Christie-ish to me.
They're really classic mysteries that way.
Mm-hmm.
And each one, when you mentioned the way they start off with the description of Wall Street, each one starts off that way.
Oh.
And it's always tweaked a little bit that kind of leads you into what they're going to set the mystery up about. I thought that was kind of – I was looking at it because there was another spot where they kind of pulled back and – were resetting things in a sense of, you know, oh shoot, I can't find it. But they're saying at the crud. Oh, they're kind of pulling back and establishing something else. And this is the beginning of chapter 12. And they say, man proposes, God disposes.
For many centuries.
Yeah, it was widely accepted. The course of human events was shaped by this division of labor. Then one of the bolder spirits of the Middle Ages put faith to the test. Does man propose? Hundreds of succeeding years were spent debating the proposition. Then, probably because Charles Darwin and Sigmund Freud between them made man uninteresting, attention was returned to the second member of the partnership. And then they use all that and a couple more paragraphs to lead into this big meeting everybody's having and how they're all dealing with it. And they're also funny.
Yeah. I was going to mention that too, when we got more into it, but all of the chapters kind of start out with a paragraph that's really kind of outside the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the first paragraph of the whole book, you know, is kind of outside the story. And what you just read is kind of outside the story. It's not that it doesn't have to do with this story, because it does, but like you said, it leads into something. But that's just an interesting thing that I picked up on, that all of the chapters open that way.
Well, it depends on where it is, because some of them will just say, he arrived at his office early with laudable intentions.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of set up the fact that this isn't the only thing he's thinking about.
Yeah, so I guess all of the chapters you're right. It's not all of them.
But they
sometimes
will
they do,
back.
Yeah. And it is interesting because it is almost the author's saying something to you and then getting back into the story.
Yeah, and it's not ever anything that's super, you know, philosophical, but it will be appropriate to what's being talked about and remind you of a bit of a bigger picture that they're putting everything in context of. And this particular mystery, as I said, it's just for a real quick recap, because there's not tons to it, is that a Catholic school is, and this is the case in so many places still today, a parish is having to lose their Catholic school. They're more of an, I don't know if you'd say inner city, but they're definitely not the suburbs.
Right, yeah.
And the diocese says, look, we just can't afford to keep this school open anymore. We're going to shut it. The real estate people are going to put up a high rise. It will be a nice high rise. It will make the neighborhood better, raise property values. And the Parents Association, and this is very real to me also, they're like, oh, really? Because our grandparents built St. Bernadette's Catholic School, and we all went there, and our kids are going there. So they form an association that's suing the diocese. And since this is in 1971, this hasn't really happened before. You know, this is kind of this new age of Catholicism after Vatican II that's kind of broken everything loose from the way people just traditionally would act in these situations. And while John Putnam Thatcher gets brought in because the Sloan is financing all of this stuff, and he has to go to some meeting to try and calm everyone down, I believe. And then at the Parents Association, a murder happens of one of the top people running it. Yeah. And because he's on the spot, the police have to interview him, and he gets kind of sucked in that way. And he keeps having to go to various meetings because the conflict is continuing while the murder's being investigated.
Yeah.
And I guess that's
yeah
a fair summary.
You bet it is. Yeah. Okay. Well put.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. There was a thing that I marked that you mentioned that they've got humor. And here's a paragraph that I marked early on. It's on page 29. He says, thus summoned, Thatcher solemnly agreed that the Sloan would not tie up mortgage money indefinitely. To show he was on the side of the Angels, though their precise location was growing more obscure by the moment, he agreed that he was against sending wreckers over a living rampart of human bodies. Yeah, I mean, these arguments are funny, you know, they're... like, yeah, let's lay in front of the bulldozers and, you know, all this stuff. And
So then you have the real estate guy going, well, I, for one, would never. Oh, me either. Well, and yeah. You also have things happening like because of all these elements being attracted by the publicity of the murder in the news, you have people coming in and throwing themselves into the mix who don't have anything to do with it, but they're there to get the attention of the media. And so there are a couple of different scenes where riots actually break out the birth control people show up and the parents are horrified because they're just traditional Catholics. And they're like, no, this is how we take back control for the women. And so they're picketing and the school is letting out. And some other Catholics who are real radical are trying to hand out birth control pills to all the teenage girls. And the fathers are coming home from work. And so they're punching out the Catholics. And so it just, the way the scene is built is hilarious.
Yeah, it is.
You know?
And it is a neat statement too, and a true statement, I think, about, you know, what happens when the spotlight gets on people. Mm-hmm. You know, once the media started to show up and it became a big news story, those others, you know, started coming out and, you know, trying to jump into that spotlight and muddy up the waters, you know. It's not like they're trying to muddy up the waters. It's just that that's what happens, and it happens all the time. Still to this day, things like that are happening.
Where I have to say, by the fourth time, which is, I think, that this is the fourth time I've read the book, as I was reading it, because I knew everything fairly well, I could really see the structure of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I remembered reading it and just kind of going along through the book and not thinking about it, and that's what made me email you at one point going, oh, I'm really worried you're not going to like it, because I could really see them just layering all the misdirections on there and obscuring the original problem.
Yeah, and the original problem, you know, I don't think that there's any way that I could have figured out who did the deed, you know what I mean? Which is still part of this book, you know, like an Agatha Christie novel, you know, who did it is all the way through it.
Oh, yeah. And it was well established at the beginning in terms of but all the clues were there.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
When you knew what to look for.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, and the thing about using John Putnam Thatcher as a detective, because he's an older guy, since he's a senior vice president of this place, he's always detached.
Yeah.
And he'll get caught up in things too, but he's always an outsider, and he always is looking at things from a banker's point of view. So he'll have a different look at everything. And that's where they get him as a detective, because he's not in the middle of all of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I did enjoy one of the things was when I said the Catholic viewpoint was how well they portrayed the Catholic community hanging together.
Yeah, yeah.
And the feelings of the people who are just the traditional people within that community, as well as people like the diocese has Monsignor Miles, who's negotiating with these people. And he's, what did they call him? He's a high-level troubleshooter. Because John Thatcher goes, Ah, he didn't care what the organization was. Any big organization has these people working for it. And his job is to put out fires wherever they come up and, uh-huh. and smooth things over and get things to working again. So it was really fun kind of seeing his point of view and the regular people's point of view. And then you had tension between a very new priest who really is fiery and wants to get into everything and the older seasoned priest who knows when to hold back and then knows when he has to get involved for the sake of the people. And it all just made a very interesting dynamic mix of characters.
Yeah. And it felt true to me, mm-hmm. you know, just from my experience in Catholic communities, you know, when something mm-hmm. happens, and the sides that are taken and the philosophies behind those sides, you know, that seemed really true to me.
Yeah. And that's what kind of surprised me. And as I say, kind of why I chose the book, because this was written in 1971, and you'd think that by now a lot of these issues would have been solved and people would have reformed into different ways of handling things. No.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's still strife between the really traditional people who are like, you know, they think of NFP, natural family planning, I think mm-hmm. is what that stands for, as, you know, kind of iffy, some of them.
Sure, sure.
You know, kind of messing with God's plan a little bit in your marriage. And then you've got the people who are like, well, of course, everybody'd use contraception. And that has shifted from what the book does. But
yeah.
It's just kind of funny that, like, there's one point in the book where there's somebody who's so innocent. She's like, well, why would anybody even use that? And the two other ladies are looking at each other going, oh, she had to try really hard to have her kid. That's mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm. Well, there's some people.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And, you know, in the depiction, you know, change is really difficult. But, you know, mm-hmm. we had a slight change in our church, when they changed some of the wording, and I still say the wrong things in mass sometimes.
Yeah.
But, you know, that Vatican II must have been huge. I just can't imagine. And you'll have people that are like, well, you know, whatever the priest says is that's what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. And then there's other people that are perfectly comfortable saying, well, he's just this guy. And, you know, we can argue against him all we want without, you know, so all those viewpoints are there. And, but yeah, coming from mostly a traditional thing where people would say, yeah, whatever he says goes.
I know. And that's why in this community, it's really a big thing for these parents to go up against the diocese
mm-hmm.
because that hadn't happened before.
And right. The diocese they're saying, are we going against the Catholic Church by fighting for this school? You know, that's the viewpoint of some people saying, no, we shouldn't mm-hmm. be doing this. And, yeah, I can't remember. There was a one time they were going to have a meeting and they said there was like 200 sets of parents or something. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
200
mm-hmm.
people that were coming in and they were going to vote on what they were going to do next at one point in the book. And
yeah, that's after Francis O'Mara is killed,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty early on in the book. So
right,
I'm not
right.
giving anything away.
It's because things were starting to get way out of hand with the media and, like you said, a riot.
And, all the other elements that have been going on. And so they have to figure out what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the other thing that was kind of good is, and I can't remember if I said this, but they also brought in all these other really current elements, especially for 1971. And they're still surprisingly kind of current today. The absentee landlords became a big issue in this book.
Yeah.
And the Arab-Israeli conflict, because at one point, and we're way into where we're telling you a lot about the book. So if you haven't read it, you know.
right.
But at one point, the parents find out there's an absentee landlord who works at the UN or lives in an apartment across from the UN. So they go down to picket. And they wind up between the Arabs and the Israelis, who are always down there picketing.
Yeah.
And so then you see those people have been all picketing so long that they all come together over, you know, oh, you didn't bring enough warm clothes. Here's some coffee. And they're getting recipes from each other. And it's funny because it changes the whole dynamic. The policemen don't know what to do with it. And, but
that is funny.
And the whole idea of changing urban centers with, you know, closing down parish schools isn't something that's really happened before at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
And some of the parents are saying, well, in a couple of years, we're going to move to the suburbs anyway. We're just fighting a rearguard action to keep it open long enough for so-and-so to get out of school. Hmm. And so they took all these very current elements, and the book at the time would have been, well, I don't want to say cutting edge because it's not gritty or anything, but it was looking at stuff that was really valid.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. When I read the part where they really commandeered the purpose of the group and changed the purpose of the group to this absentee landlord thing, mm-hmm. everybody was like, wait a minute, this was about the school. You know, what's going mm-hmm. on? I thought that was a really interesting thing, too. And also a thing, you know, the spotlight of the media and being taken over by a bigger purpose, you know, bigger in these people's eyes, mm-hmm. You know, from this one specific thing into, oh, wow, you know, we can really fight for this big thing. And I think that happens, too.
Yeah, we can fight for our whole neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah. And now
because that hit something that touched people who even didn't have kids, who are like, yeah, the light bulb in my hallway never gets changed.
Exactly. Yes. And then the people, one of the leaders said, well, I've got to resign because this has nothing to do with what I was here for. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I just thought that was really well done.
Well, and then leaders start emerging who never would have had that role otherwise, mm-hmm. because the consensus of the group who was running the original, you know, Parents to Save St. Bernadette's or whatever it was called, suddenly go, you're the person to do this. And I think it's Bob Horvath who's like, whoa, what? Mm-hmm. No, I'm just a truck driver. But he turns out to be somebody at that time who's yeah. needed.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know, it was just really an interesting look at how all these dynamics work together because, you know, they're just doing it for the story. But when we're looking at it for this podcast, I suddenly started thinking about, well, how are conflicts with the church handled today? Everybody's much more comfortable about the church. How dare they try to close down my parish? Mm. But it's still something that we have our own tension with, isn't it? I mean, it's that thing you said about the people who just take whatever the priest says and run with it versus those who will question everything. And the right spot is somewhere in between.
Yeah, it is somewhere in between. Yeah, we can't be people that sit here and let bad things occur without saying something. But at the same time, we are trusting the church to run the church, you know, as far as... You know, we have parish councils for those people who don't know, too. I mean, we have parish councils mm-hmm. who, you know, deal with the money and finance councils.
Yeah.
So there are group decisions being made. Yeah, they advise the priest, right? But the priest gets to make the decisions. You know, so there is involvement of the laity in these decisions. But you're right. That, you know, for someone to say... well, you know, that's just wrong, you know, to a bishop or something like that is not, unheard of. And, you know, happens all the time nowadays. And I don't know that it happened a lot in the past. I don't know. I wasn't in the past, but it does seem like it's perfectly acceptable for people to question everything. Mm-hmm. You know, from the most minute decisions. and there are, you know, in the Catholic communities, we do have, people who bicker about everything, you know, yeah, mm-hmm. people that bicker about everything. And then all the way up to people who bicker about nothing.
Yeah.
And every person in between, you know, the most small things where you're like, oh, yeah. It's just like,
yeah,
oh, wow.
And, you know, because if, mm-hmm. And to be fair, I think there was too much before of that mindset of, well, whatever the priest says, because if people had been more aware and thinking and paying more attention, you wouldn't have had the sex scandals that we had in this country.
Right. Yep.
Too many people were ignoring what was going on.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, because there was a huge problem with the former bishop here.
Mm-hmm.
Or I guess it was two ago. But the bishop who came behind him had lost sight of what was right in terms of the people versus protecting the church, and protecting the church is a valid thing too, but not when it's at the expense of human beings. And
right.
So that caused a huge schism between, I'd say, about 95% of the Catholics in Dallas and their bishop. So
Yeah. And the same thing in Boston, right?
Yeah. And a bunch of other places, mm-hmm. you know, and now look at Ireland. And
yeah,
it's the thing of forgetting that when you're protecting the church is the people, by the way, you know, it's not right. just the institution.
Yeah. And I think that's where they got away from it is, you know, this thought that the institution needed to be protected, because of people that will think ill of it or whatever their reasoning was, you know, from outside of it, it's just shocking. You know, it's like, you know, what the heck are you thinking? It's just stunning.
Well, so, and it just passed through my mind while we were talking about all this. I was thinking, well, also, though, it's the same tension we experience in life itself, but with God. I mean, I think we're not supposed to question God. We're not supposed to go, what the heck? But, you know, we're free to do it.
Yeah.
Look at all those examples in the Bible of, you know, Abraham going, whoa, what? You're going to do what to, was it Sodom and Gomorrah? You're going to, well, what if you find 50 good people? You won't wipe it out? I mean, it's legitimate for us to question things and make sure that we understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. God doesn't want us to not ask questions, but we also can't just be rebellious for the sake of rebellion because my way is better or right, I don't want to listen.
Yeah. It's and asking questions. Yeah. That's different from saying that, I know better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Saying, well, what about this? Is this an okay way to handle this situation? How do I do this? And, you know, unquestioning obedience is fine too, depending on what you're being unquestioningly obedient to. You have to make sure it's God's will and not your own. We're like, oh, this is my idea.
Yeah.
You know, cause
that's and that's something that I have, you know, with people that are just, you know, question everything and get angry so easily over things. The thing that I always wonder is, you know, well, how do you know the other perspective here? You know, what is the reason that the church is doing this? You know, whether it be closing a building or whatever. Why are they doing it, first of all? What is their point of view? You know, I much prefer people who actually take the time, okay, let's figure out why it's happening, and then we can decide, you know, well, that's invalid or not. But just the fact that something's closing, to just react and get angry about that, you need more information. It's not like they're doing it just to be mean. You know, you've got to trust the motives of the other side, that they're not doing this for nefarious reasons.
Well, and it is legitimate to do something like that parents group where you go because they couldn't get anybody's ear. And it was really interesting. I thought the one little bit where they sit down and go, well, here's a list of options nobody's thought of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could double up with these people.
And
we could do all
here's great what other stuff right there.
People across the country. Yep. And they're like, but the bishop didn't do that. He just sold instantly. He didn't even ask us.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that conversation is legitimate.
It is. Yep. I agree.
But I really thought when looking at this that it was going to be much more of an antiquated look at how things were working right then. Instead of, here we are right now. Same kind of situations, you know.
And it was written in 1971. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you're right. When I was reading that, the people that were there, I know those people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. 2014. I know those people. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they really did an excellent job of talking to someone or having somebody look at it who said, oh, here's because one of my favorite bits, if I can find it really quickly, was how hard it can be to understand the Catholic mindset where the real estate guy handling the deal and John Thatcher are talking about things. And he says, they're talking about the chairman who's an undertaker. And they said, you know, he has to think bigger about business. He's not just, he can understand the big picture on why there's not enough money and they need to sell the school. And Unger said he should see that the parish literally can't afford to keep the school running. And if they're not going to operate a school, they'd be fools to turn down a good offer for the property. It isn't as if we were planning to put up a factory. If anything, property values are going to go up once we've built. Thatcher agreed that this was simple logic and inquired where Francis O'Mara failed to follow. He elicited a muffled groan. I can't really say, said Dick Unger, baffled. He starts talking about Catholic education, and he loses me. You know, and I'm like, oh, yeah, those are code words, you know, and every community has its own code words. And when he said that, he starts talking about Catholic education. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's eliciting a whole way of life and tradition and something much deeper than just profit.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you don't stop and explain it to people on the outside, they're not going to really understand that viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like I was having an email discussion with somebody on Goodreads, and this is, I don't know because it's just an alias, but I believe it's a young Spanish guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he suddenly got into movies, and he was just, I liked the movie Alamo, the most recent one with Billy Bob Thornton. And he was like, oh, it was a terrible movie and this and that. And it didn't do this right. And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. You're talking to a Texan here. That movie was pretty good. I was like, there are deeper waters for Americans and Texans on this issue. And that movie did what it needed to do.
Oh, that's cool.
And he's like, yeah, but. And he comes back to these other things. I'm like, yeah, I get you. Those were technical. The emotional level worked.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not his point of view.
Right, right.
So.
Yeah, true. Yep. Yeah. You know, kind of dovetailing into what you're saying is, you know, they displayed the kind of the liberal Catholic point of view in here as well.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, people were. You know, the fight gets nasty sometimes. The part that I marked, there was just some lady talking here, and she says she's really close to tears. She says,
yeah.
Those are mature and dedicated Catholic church women, Father, she informed him. We are deeply, vitally concerned about our church. For you to call it vulgarity simply proves how out of contact too many parish priests are with the problems of the modern Catholic faces. And I'm trying to recall that there was another thing that, oh, somebody was talking about progress. They said, you know, how can you possibly, you know, how is the church ever going to progress if we don't do this?
Right.
And that's a viewpoint that's very prevalent today. You know, even from people outside the church who criticize certain things in the church and say, well, they're never going to move on without changing these things. And you're like, well, first of all, what does move on mean? And what does progress mean? And right. Are these goals of the church or not? And I don't think that they are.
Yeah, you know,
the whole idea of progress is like, you know, well, what does that mean exactly? And it's you know, so you're talking about different points of view. You know, to a certain person, the progress is the point of view that doesn't make sense to a lot of Catholics.
Well, and that's why I really loved that this one character who is often given a lot more time in various different books, but Charlie, what's his name? Charlie Trinkum.
Mm-hmm.
He's famous as a playboy in these books, but he always is kind of attached to a woman who knows a lot about whatever's going on. And in this case, he has been hanging out with somebody who's a social worker, but she used to be a nun. And he says, and I thought this was perfect. He says, tell me, Thatcher inquired, as usual, taking advantage of Charlie's peculiar insights. What does she say about the current upheaval on the worldwide scene? Charlie quoted dutifully. She says that the reformers who talk about the church's lack of involvement with social issues are historically inaccurate. The church's structure is designed for involvement. But the structure has gotten frozen and social patterns have changed. What's going on is the travail of realignment. Incidentally, she says that birth control and abortion are just two facets of the central problem of our times. Sex? Walter had fallen into the trap. No, Charlie proclaimed triumphantly. The equality of woman. She says that the church has a lot to learn there. Hmm. And I don't necessarily agree with that either. But it was the way, I mean, all that stuff. I'm like, wow, you could just take that paragraph and apply it to everything. That's why they had Vatican II. The structure was frozen and they were trying to, it had gotten brittle. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to open things up. And change is always liberating and terrifying and chaotic, I think you could say. And until you settle down with the change and, you know, until you figure out how to handle it, you've got these problems.
Right, right. Yeah, and you've got people that are very happy with the changes, and you've got people that are, like you said, horrified by them, mm-hmm. having spent their entire lives doing things a certain way. You know, it's that's why, you know, I don't think the church should change things to change them. You know, right. It's just too delicate. It's just it affects people in a negative way. Some people.
Yeah. And these days we want things to change instantly, react instantly. Mm-hmm. And the church is often criticized, and especially from within, that it's too slow. It's like trying to turn an aircraft carrier mm-hmm. around. It takes some time. But a lot of times what we forget is some of these instant changes being called for are too quick reactions. Time hasn't been taken to really assess the whole problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if the church's goal, which gets forgotten a lot by everybody at all levels, but is our salvation, progress may be called for on certain points, but it's not automatically the thing that you want. And when I look at a lot of what other churches are doing, Western churches especially, to try to keep up with the times, I wonder how much of that they're going to have to change in another 5 to 10 years when current thinking changes again somehow.
Yeah. 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 And it's difficult. We can't react to every whim of, you know, society.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If the big goal is to love the human person and show them they have value and hopefully, you know, salvation, show them where they can find salvation, then you have to take care of the individual people, which is why a lot of times it looks like the church is confused in a sense, because like while the government's trying to figure out what to do about all these child immigrants coming in, the church is going, the legality of these people isn't our problem. Feeding them and giving them somewhere to sleep is.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're in there taking care of it.
And that was really great. I was really appreciative of those people who did that.
Yeah, I was proud.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead. I was just going to say there is something really comforting to me in to have that slow moving aircraft carrier in this world full of bees and bees mm-hmm. and little tiny planes zipping around everywhere. To have something that's slow moving is actually very comforting.
Yeah, because in fact, I was telling my husband just yesterday about another one of these things where it's a situation kind of like this, where it's the current issue and some incident is happening and everybody's just, you know, the internet's made it worse in terms of, you know, everybody reacting and judging instantly, as we've discussed before. And it's Cardinal Dolan, I think, is going to be the... Is he going to be the Grand Marshal of the St. Patrick's Day Parade in New York? Is that it? Or he's just going to be on a float or something? Mm-hmm. And they're going to have gay people marching for the first time. And I could be misrepresenting little pieces of this because now I've lost track of the whole thread of what the everybody's mad about. But basically, there are all these people who, like Phil Horvath in this book, who's a steadfast, don't ever give an inch to anything, are like, what are you doing in that parade?
Mm-hmm.
You're in there with... They're promoting homosexuality and you're a Catholic, you know, cardinal. And then you have people who are going, yeah, this shows the church doesn't have to be hung up about that sex stuff. And whereas really, I think I read something the anchoress wrote, Elizabeth Scalia wrote yesterday, and she was saying, well, he's called to be Christ and not the Pharisees. Christ was out eating with the gamblers and the prostitutes. And, you know, it didn't mean he was saying everything they did was great, but he was acknowledging them as people. And I was like, I was listening to that and thinking and going, well, you know, also, who's he to say who should and shouldn't be in a parade?
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, that was going to be what I was going to say. It's, you know, the,
it's not his parade.
It's not his parade. Right. And, yeah, it just all this anger, man, just, you know, it's frustrating. It makes me angry too. It's, you know, just like, okay, just take a deep breath. You know, that's what the internet seems to be right now, is a conduit for conflict. It's like, you know, here's the latest thing that we're all going to be extremely upset about. And, man, it's just like a snowball.
I know.
And, yeah, I mean, everybody's sitting at their computers getting angry about stuff and putting more crap on the internet that's talking about how angry they are. And somehow it seems to me that so many people view that as, valuable to society. You know, my anger and me throwing this stuff out is important. And this is me being active, you know, this is me being actively, a part of this social, society or whatever, you know, gosh, and you know, go outside and go run something for office or something, you know?
Where's your passion? Go actively do something about it.
Right. Go do something about something. There's something near you that you can go be part of.
Because otherwise you're like, you know, the stereotype of the old men sitting around playing checkers and griping about things. Yeah, that's essentially what you're doing. We've got a whole nation of those people now.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it feels like to me. I don't know everybody, obviously, but, but it's just like, you know, you sit here and you look at that and you're just like, oh man, here's the latest thing, you know, on Twitter or something, you know, you get people that, you know, starting to tweet about something and you're just like, oh really?
I have people who I enjoy a lot of what they put on Facebook, but eventually I wound up going, you know, what I really don't want to ever talk to you about is politics. And I don't want to talk to you about religion. That's why, guess what? When we're talking, I don't talk about those things. Mm-hmm. So therefore I just don't even follow their feeds.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, you know, I really like you. And when I see this one-sided snarky thing come out, and I understand when we're all in our little groups, it's nice to kind of relax and, you know, you poke fun at the other, and in a sense it's kind of harmless, but you know, if it's just a passing thing, but I don't want to have to be exposed to it from my five liberal friends who are like super mouthy, or my five super conservative friends who are always sending around the latest outrage that's happened, you know, and I'm just like, you're so nice in person. I don't like this side of you.
Yeah. And you're right. That is exactly right. You know, there's two sides to everything. And I often get both, you know, where I get the, you know, conservatives seem to be really fond of, these emails that you send in with all these, you know, quote unquote facts about, you know, whatever. And, most of the time, you know, you can look at, just look something up.
Go to like, Snopes.com.
Yeah, just
it's
something.
Always never true.
Yeah, so I get those, and I get the comments, you know, a lot of from the liberal side, where it seems like the mindset there is often, well, of course, this is the way we should think. You know, and it's almost like if you are thinking differently from that, then, you know, it's you're completely invalid, and it's almost not even worth talking about. So
yeah, at the best, you're a simpleton who's never thought deeper.
Exactly.
And let me instruct you.
Mm-hmm.
And at the worst, you're the worst kind of bigot, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, and I have had a couple things where I've just innocently thought, oh, this is just an amusing situation, and I'll put something on there, and my liberal friends just, oh, well. And I'm like, man, you just make life no fun at all. This wasn't like that at all.
Yeah.
You just read that into it.
Right. So it is both sides, like, you know, both of them. And it's just,
and it's not
frustrating.
Like I'm perfect. I can fall either way. And for some, it occurs to me, for somebody who's got a blog and a podcast, and I am also putting plenty out there, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all out there. Yep.
Yeah. But it's, I think what it is it's that echo chamber situation where if you only hang out with your own kind, so to speak, you don't realize how you sound to the outside.
Yeah. And yeah.
I have a brother-in-law who, love him, but we were in a situation in a hospital one time where Tom and I were like, oh my gosh, the things that you're saying in your really loud voice, and oh, here's a, you know, the person who's helping Tom's mother, who we were sitting with, we're like, oh, she's black and she's female and she's what? What are you saying? We're like, we know that's just you, but nobody else does. And later on, we thought, wow, this person is surrounded by people like just like him. Other than maybe for business where you're adjusting it, but in just relaxed conversation, and these are the things that we were hearing were things that were astounding us actually. And we would never have thought to say something like that. And, but it's like, were you, well, I'll make allowances, but here we are with all these other people who aren't like you, who talks like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
And I guess that's part of what they're dealing with in the book is that echo chamber thing of it, these echo chambers were all being broken open at that time.
Yeah. And I think that this is one of the values of reading books, too, is to break yourself out of some of that. Where, you know, like this book, for example, I don't know if you did, but I saw myself in some of that where you're like, oh, okay. You know, and it helps me see the other point of view, you know, like I was saying, where you're like, okay, well, you know, it just develops understanding. I think that reading fiction, that's a real value, is understanding other people.
Yes. And not always reading things that you agree with. Mm-hmm. Like when we read Pavan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's, then it comes down to, okay, here's this element that I'm going to set aside or just kind of let go. What else is there in the book?
Mm-hmm.
Can I accept it? Is it a value?
Yeah. And valves. Are there enough valves in this fiction? You know, there wasn't any valves in this whole book. There was no valves.
And not enough descriptions of how everything worked, really lovingly. I just want to say.
All right.
No scenery at all.
We'll try to do better.
But I would really recommend any of Emma Lathan's books. As I say, the later ones weren't my favorites, but they were still good enough. They primo.
You mentioned that you had a favorite. Do you have a favorite of them that leaps out to you?
I have.
Or did you already mention that? I can't remember if you did.
Yeah. One of them is called Murder to Go, and it's based around the fast food industry. Where somebody is eating some of this chicken that it's, you know, and they are poisoned. And it's from the point of view of the franchise owners, this couple who runs the franchise, and it's their chicken that poisons somebody. And John Putnam Thatcher's brought in because, you know, is the whole franchise going to go down? So you find out how everything works. And then the other one that I love, and this is so unlikely, but it's called Pick Up Sticks. And it's kind of this interesting combination of looking at the, gosh, now, is it the Appalachian Trail? Is that the name of it?
That trail that goes
all the way up from Georgia all the way up to the...
Oh, yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. That with the idea of vacation homes, because John Thatcher is on his annual 2-week vacation with his super enthusiastic, hilariously drawn friend who is just into everything. And they rescue somebody who is ill-equipped to walk the trail. And while they're going down trying to find somebody to help this person, they come across a murder that's happened in this place where they're building all these vacation homes. And it's the kind of thing where they'll say, come for a free weekend. And then they spend the whole time doing sales talks to get you to buy one of these homes.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't think that would be one of my favorites, but I just, these characters are so great. And there's real insight into how this whole scam, well, it's not a scam, but how this whole sales setup works. And it's just, I love it. And also the going for the gold about the Olympics was good. The Sloan is doing all the banking the international banking for the Olympics. And you never think about how that works and everything that has to go into it.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's told from the point of view of the athletes, because an athlete is killed.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, I'm just looking at a whole bunch of these. That's neat. Yeah, they've all, you know, people really like them. You know, like you said, they're all like 4 stars rated.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, very nice.
They're just not really easily available. And I've often thought of asking for permission to read one on Forgotten Classics.
Uh-huh.
But it's hard to work with publishers. It's much easier to work with authors, and both these ladies are dead. So.
Oh, dear. Yep.
Yes, I know. So I haven't gotten into that. I've skipped that for other things. But
yeah.
But yeah, that's and I don't want to make it sound like these are, it sounds like they could be dry,
mm-hmm.
but the way they write personalities and situations, there's plenty of humor and, I don't know, just interest, I think.
Yeah, I thought so too. I enjoyed it.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
good.
Yeah. But I agree with you. There's a lot of humor in it. You know, laugh out loud moments where you're like, oh man, that's funny.
Yeah, like, and that I one had read this. Right. And I read this book several times before I was Catholic and never really thought about the education I was getting into, you know, mm-hmm. just if I cared about how all that stuff worked. It was just a good mystery to me. So,
yeah,
I just chose this one because of the Catholic element.
Right. Right.
I thought it was interesting that they went so deeply into it.
Yeah. And it is. Yeah. And they got it right.
Yeah. And I can't remember if I mentioned this, but there was one section where the widow of the person who's killed, John Thatcher is at the funeral, and he's observing all the kinds of help that are coming into her. And he said, you know, this is the kind of thing that's starting to be eliminated in our world, but this person is at the heart of a community that is going to support her and help her through this whole period in a way that a lot of people don't get. She's got the church, she's got all the school families, because it's a close-knit community on a lot of levels. And so this, he does just a touch of musing on that. And I thought, you know, people would say that doesn't exist anymore in our world, but at my church, it does.
Yeah.
There are different groups of people, and it's a very large church, so you don't know everyone. But I realize sometimes when I'm sitting at Mass, I'll look at how many people I know, and there might be 500 people at that Mass. But, you know, you sit in the same section and that kind of thing. But I'll think, oh, I know those people from helping with the marriage retreat. Oh, I know those people from when I helped with the RCIA classes. And, oh, this person I know because I went through this retreat. And which I guess says that you have to get a touch involved before you start to really become part of anything.
Yeah, I think so, too. Yeah, that was one of the things that I noticed about, you know, when I decided to go ahead and get confirmed again. Or not mm-hmm. again, kind of rejoin the church, meaning,
right.
you know, because I had fallen away and I got confirmed as an adult.
Yeah.
So it was, I don't know, 15, 16 years ago.
Yeah.
But when you make that decision to go ahead and start participating, it changes everything because mm-hmm. before that, you know, you're looking at, or I was looking at things and reading things and, you know, just kind of skimming on the surface. But then when you start to participate, then it starts to take on the depth. And then you can just be going to Mass. But then when you participate further by taking a job, like right now I'm doing inquiry group. We had a meeting last night. And one of the things that I noticed about that is it's helpful to me, mm-hmm. not only in the way that you're saying in that I'm meeting people, but also in that the questions that I get help me understand my faith as well. And
yes.
you're getting this depth that you're getting by participation, which you don't get by not participating. It just adds another, there's just more depth to it.
Yeah.
It's
and
worth
there's
the
something
time. Yeah.
Also about person to person interaction.
Mm-hmm.
It's never as easy as you pretend it can be on, say, Facebook or Twitter or any of these other ways, you know, just reading or writing emails to each other. I mean, there still may be struggles with things, but people are just, they do things and say things you don't expect, and you have to adjust in different ways that are good for both of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, just that face-to-face interaction. And so all these, and I sound like I'm pointing fingers, but I'm not. I have to relearn this lesson all the time. But anybody who's passionate about something, rather than just making your wishes known, and what, no matter what it is, you're going to benefit a lot more personally, too, if you do something that's involved with it. Mm-hmm. You know, do you care about immigrants? Help in a soup kitchen. Do you, you know, are you mad at the immigration laws? Well, maybe. And you can vote and change that, or you can run for office, like you said. But you can also go down and do hands-on help.
Yeah.
You can make a difference for people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I said, when once a year, we, Tom and I, do the March for Life. And there's something just even about that, and talking to the people in the crowd and seeing all that, that's kind of, it changes how we think about things and how we participate and feel. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, we're meant to be out there.
I think we are meant to be out there. You know, I had a really good friend who once told me, he's an Episcopalian priest.
Mm-hmm.
And he, we were talking about some things. This is before I'd gone back to the Catholic Church. And he just the fact of being alone with your ideas. And again, you know, kind of like we were talking about earlier, you know, being in a safe little box where you're not allowing anyone to talk to you about those ideas or that don't agree with you already, but just talking about them out loud with someone else, it helps you unravel things. Mm-hmm. And it also helps you, you can have some ideas in your head that if you don't express them, you don't know that they're ridiculous. So there's that added thing as well, where you start to talk about them and somebody can say, you know, did that make sense what you just said? Well, no, it didn't actually.
And there's something about having to articulate your ideas, even if it's just writing them down, which is kind of going away from what you're saying, that makes you really have to think about them in a different way too.
Yeah.
That's, my husband is experiencing that because our business is not, you know, it's going through another change, period of change, which is worrying, but it's kind of exhilarating for him in a way because he's completely rewriting our website and applying a lot of the things that he'll advise to our other clients, but that we haven't done because, you know, the shoemaker's kids never have any shoes. And so he's having to articulate things in writing in a way he's never had to do. And so it's been a horrible struggle and he hates it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's kind of making him come alive too, because he's really grappling with these ideas and wrestling them through. He's not just talking about them. He's having to put them on paper, which is a different kind of interaction, I guess. But for him, he usually is talking to people about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe part of it is changing too, what you do.
Right, right.
I was trying to find, there's somebody, it's either, well, I think many of the wise men have said something like this. There's, okay, St. Francis of Assisi, the journey is essential to the dream.
Hmm.
And I would say the journey is that interaction that we're talking about and getting in there and wrestling with it yourself. Oh, and here's the other one, St. Augustine from his Confessions. It is one thing to see the land of peace from the wooded ridge and another to tread the road that leads to it.
Hmm.
And I always took that to mean, you have to get out there and do it.
Yeah.
You know, that interaction with people and not just sitting around and talking about it.
Yeah. I found it to be very important.
Well, and like this podcast, you know, the fact that
too.
I'm reading books in order, and movies, seeing movies in order to discuss them, it's changing how I do everything.
Yeah. And me as well. Yeah. It certainly changes how I read. Yeah, and thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, and this is episode 91.
I know.
We're working on something very cool for episode 100.
Yeah, we won't say but we have a surprise coming up.
Yeah.
Oh, now we've really got to come through, by the way.
That's right. We've really got to come through. Yeah, ice cream sandwiches for everybody. That's what we're working on.
Oh, thank goodness we've only got three listeners. The FedEx on getting those things there unmelted is going to be horrific.
It can be done. It can be done.
It's America. Of course we can do it.
Heck yeah. Heck yeah. So what's coming up here? I got to call up this website.
Life of Brian.
Oh, yes. Brian. The baby called Brian. That, to my husband last night. That podcast, all we're going to do is just, we're going to do the whole movie for you. Yeah. Just from start to finish.
I know. Yeah. So you don't need to listen to it. You already know most of the jokes. I
love it.
And if you haven't ever seen it, out of some misconception that it's just blasphemous, which is what some of the more rigid people thought when it came out, that's wrong.
Yeah.
Completely wrong.
You bet. And October is here. Almost.
Yes.
Leaves are changing. Salem's Lot by Stephen King on October the 10th.
You know, I picked that up from the library yesterday, and a young woman in line said, "That's the best book. It's the first horror book I ever read, and it's so wonderful."
Awesome.
So,
and it is.
A lot of Stephen King love out there for that book. Yeah.
Cool. And then Super 8. Yep. That's a movie. And then in November, The Catholic Church Through the Ages. We're going to talk about a religious book. So, yep. And I've got my copy. It has arrived.
Yeah, and I've begun reading mine. I had to keep from talking about it several times during this podcast because you want to talk about dealing with change.
Nice. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to all of those things.
Yes, me too.
And the things that come after.
Oh, by the way, speaking of all this social media and everything, you know, we rarely remember to do this, but I just started a Facebook page.
Oh, for cool. Us. Okay.
So, we're on Facebook and
we're on the Facebook.
And I think you can link the Twitter to the Facebook. So we'll have to look at that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And we've got a Twitter feed called, Good Story Found. At Good Story Found. And, and I'm on Twitter as well. I'm not on Facebook, but I am on Twitter.
Well, I cover the Facebook angle because I have a Twitter feed, but I never read it. Yeah. I just put things on there for people who are on Twitter and not anywhere else. And then we have the blog for the podcast, which is a good story is hard to find .blogspot.com. And we also have iTunes where, you know, I hate to beg for reviews, but, you know, if you like us, want to see us go to 900. Okay, that's too many.
900 episodes?
Yeah.
Yeah. But, without repeating a single item.
Oh my gosh. I think we could do it, Scott. I think we could.
You know, maybe next year we should just start over and then start doing the same order. We'll start with the Reapers of the Angels.
Oh, well, really? Because I don't think I have to renew my library card that day. Like I could be there.
Yeah.
But I will say I have been listening to some older episodes, and maybe I've mentioned this before because I'm copying some of them onto CDs for an older friend of mine who only has the boombox, but she likes to hear them.
That's beforehand neat.
I listen to them just to make sure that I don't have to go, oh, and by the way, we do talk about this. And I have been really pleased at how listenable they are.
Oh, good.
I'm really sorry. Sometimes I'm like, I don't even remember we talked about that. So,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so if we're not coming out often enough, go back and pick one of the older ones and listen to it again.
Heck yeah. Yep, like the Reapers of the Angels, episode 1.
Which is such a great one.
Is it a good one? Cool. I need to listen to it again.
Yeah, it actually is a really good episode.
That's cool. It's a really great book. It's a really great book.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we're
we've kept the standard
getting into October, and I get, you know, I just start feeling like reading some of this stuff again. You know, like, The Reapers of the Angels is one that, yeah. And I don't even have a copy of that anymore. I, my wife gave it to somebody. It was somebody that, you know, she lent it out and I was like, sure. Yeah, go ahead. But now I am, bookless. So I've got to order another one.
No.
Yeah.
Well, also, I was actually, and the reason I was thinking of this when you mentioned October is I was listening to the Haunting of Hill House episode, which was in October. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned listening to The Halloween Tree.
Oh, yes. Read by Bronson Pinchot, I think.
Yeah. And yep. I was like, oh, I've got to put that on my iPod. October's coming up.
October, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, for anybody who hasn't ever been over to Forgotten Classics, I'm almost done with the book we're reading, and I am going to be doing some spooky short stories leading up to October.
As will I. So
if you want those, and I believe I'm going to have a guest contributor. promised.
Yep. This week, and I'm hoping. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's all cross our fingers.
Oh, man.
So
exciting.
Well, that's enough social media promotion for now.
All right.
For months, I believe. So
sounds good. Well, yeah. Thanks everybody for listening.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Yes. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Yeah. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.